Okay, let's get started. It's a little bit slow there to get things organized today, but now we can begin. So this today is the Satipatthana Sutta, the Foundations of Mindfulness, it's called here. And this is an interesting sutta. It's all about very practical things, about how to practice meditation, how to develop the mind, a very important sutta. And there are a lot of interesting things to be talked about this particular sutta. And before I actually start the sutta proper, I'm going to give a little bit of an introduction about the meaning of Satipatthana, a broader contextual understanding of what Satipatthana is all about. Because one of the problems with reading the Satipatthana Sutta itself is that all things in the Buddha's teachings are interrelated. They all connect up in like a vast network. And the only way you can understand what Satipatthana is to understand how it fits in with the rest of the teaching. And when you understand how it fits into with the rest of the teaching, then you can sort of see what its purpose is and why we're actually doing this, what we're trying to achieve with this particular thing called Satipatthana. And you will find that in Buddhism, very often the Satipatthana Sutta is considered by many people as being particularly important, and particularly over the last 50 to 100 years, the Satipatthana Sutta has often been said to be the most important sutta in the Pali Canon, and had always been praised to a very high extent. And of course the question is, why do people say that? And there really is only one good reason for saying that one particular teaching or one particular sutta is more important than any other sutta. And that reason would be that the Buddha himself says so in the suttas, that this sutta has particular significance. Does the Buddha ever say that this sutta has particular significance? And the answer is no, he doesn't actually say that. So I think that one has to be very careful when people go around saying that this sutta is particularly significant. There isn't really any good reason for saying that. It is one sutta among many. All the suttas are important, but there's no real reason for singling this sutta out and saying that it's more important than other suttas. It is just one sutta among many. That doesn't make it unimportant. It just means that it's not any more or any less important than any other sutta. So that is an important thing to keep in mind. Now the second thing for understanding the Satipatthana Sutta is, as I said before, to understand how Satipatthana is used in context in the suttas. And the context is found in many, many different places. In particular, it's found in a place called the Satipatthana Sanyutta, in the Sanyutta Nikaya, where there's a large number of suttas on Satipatthana. It's also found, if you read, for example, about the Noble Eightfold Path, you will see the Noble Eightfold Path, of course, has eight factors. The seventh of those factors is Satipatthana. Now, the eighth factor is Samadhi, which is like jhana, or deep, very deep meditations. And the sixth factor before Satipatthana is right effort, which is basically how to purify the mind of defilements using skillful means. And an important point here is to remember that the Noble Eightfold Path is a sequential path. The factors come one after the other. So to understand the purpose of Satipatthana, why we practice this thing, you have to look at the sequence in the Noble Eightfold Path. Right effort leads to Satipatthana, and Satipatthana in turn leads to Samadhi, to right concentration or right stillness of the mind, otherwise also known as the jhanas. So the purpose of Satipatthana, and this is actually incredibly important, and this is something you see again and again in the suttas, many different places. It is sometimes which is rarely talked about, and the reason is because it's not actually explicitly mentioned in the Satipatthana Sutta itself, but it's mentioned in so many other places. The purpose is actually to achieve samadhi. That is why you practice Satipatthana. And that is something very few people realize. We find this in many places. You find it in Majjhima 25, I think it is, the Danta Bhumi Sutta, you see Satipatthana coming before Samma Samadhi. You find this in the Satipatthana Sutta. You find it in suttas in the Digha Nikaya. The sequence is very, very clear. And that means it puts Satipatthana in context. So what then is it about? And what it is about then is to refine and purify the mind of the last fine defilements that are present before you can attain deep meditation. That is the purpose, to refine out, to sort out the last little defilements that block you from attaining deep meditation. Also, its purpose then is to focus the mind on an object so that it actually can attain that state of stillness and unity that is required for deep meditation. So those two are the real purposes of Sammasati, Satipatthana: refine the mind from defilements and help it to focus on one particular object, so the mind becomes focused and still. But of course, as I said before, what comes before Satipatthana is right effort on the Noble Eightfold Path. And the purpose of right effort is also to purify the mind. So in other words, when you come to Satipatthana, you already have a mind which is very pure before you can practice this type of meditation. So this is the very kind of refined defilements that we're talking about here, that you are purifying using this particular practice. Now you might wonder, if Satipatthana is about moving towards Samadhi, what does that mean about Satipatthana? Does it mean that Satipatthana is a Samadhi practice, a Sammata practice? Sammata means calm, right? Is it a Sammata practice? Or is it a Vipassana practice? Vipassana means it can sometimes translate as insight, but I prefer to translate it as clarity or clear seeing. Vipassana quite literally means seeing. Passana means to see. So Vipassana is like seeing with insight or seeing with clarity. So what is it? Is it true to say that it's all about Sammata practice because it leads to Samadhi? And no, the answer is, and this is one of the things we will see here as we go through this sutta, is that Satipatthana is both about Vipassana and Sammata. It's both about seeing things clearly and also about calming the mind. And the reason then that this leads to Samadhi is because it requires both insight, or both clear seeing and calm, to get you to Samadhi, to get you to these deep states of stillness inside. Both Vipassana and Sammata are required. And you will see this in some teachings of the Buddha. You have the famous sutta in the Dhammapada, which says that there is no wisdom without jhana. Jhana is deep Samadhi. There is no jhana without wisdom. There's no wisdom without jhana. But one who has both is in the presence of Nibbana. In other words, you have to have wisdom to attain Samadhi. There's no Samadhi without wisdom. And that's why both Vipassana and Sammata are required for attaining Samadhi. Samma Samadhi, the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So keep this in mind as we go through this, that the purpose here is to move towards Samadhi, deep stillness, deep unity of the mind. This is the first thing. The second thing I want to talk about as an introductory theme is, how do we actually practice some of these, you might call them exercises, that are mentioned in the Satipatthana Sutta? It is not obvious, because one of the exercises here is the contemplation of feeling. And it doesn't actually say, how do we contemplate feeling? Do we just sort of walk around and watch what's happening in our mind or in our body? Do we sort of, watch and contemplate feelings at any time during the day? Or do we have to sit down and cross our legs and contemplate feelings? It doesn't actually say. It just says we watch the feelings. And to find out how to do this, there is another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Anapanasati Sutta. And this is a very interesting sutta, because it says in that sutta that by practicing Anapanasati, Anapanasati is the mindfulness of the breath. This is like the very standard, the most common of all the meditation teachings given by the Buddha, and the one that the Buddha himself is supposed to have used before his enlightenment. And it says in that sutta that simply by watching the breath and by practicing anapanasati, you are fulfilling satipatthana. You're not just practicing it, you're fulfilling it. You're completing satipatthana by watching the breath. So in other words, if you want to practice satipatthana, all you need to do is watch the breath. That is all you have to do. And by watching the breath, you are completing satipatthana. And this shows you then how you do things like vedananupassana. Vedananupassana means the contemplation of feeling. The way you contemplate feeling is by watching the breath. And then when you watch the breath and you become peaceful, you become quiet, all kind of feelings arise inside of you. All this happiness, this piti, the sukha. Piti is like rapture. You can feel it physically in the body sometimes. The sukha, which is a very peaceful kind of happiness, which comes later on. These are the type of feelings that you can contemplate as you are watching the breath. And it's with the watching of the breath that you actually contemplate these feelings. And that is a very useful thing. And I think that it is the only place in the suttas that the Buddha literally explains how one can practice these kind of satipatthanas. In other words, watching the breath is sufficient. And you don't have to do anything else. And you can complete and fulfill satipatthana practice by doing just that. And that is a very useful thing to keep in mind, because sometimes you can read about satipatthana and there are some massive manuals published about how it can be practiced and what you should be doing and all these things. But actually, it is not as complex as you might think. It can be all put down to a single meditation object, and that is watching the breath and nothing else. That is sufficient to complete satipatthana practice. So that is just by way of introduction. And it is not, of course, there's much more to it than that, but that is at least a very good grounding and framework for how to understand this sutta. So now let's begin with the sutta itself. And the name of the sutta, it is called Satipatthana Sutta. Satipatthana is often translated as foundations of mindfulness. That's how it's translated here. I must admit, I don't particularly like this translation all that much, because what does foundation of mindfulness mean? Think about it, foundation of mindfulness. It means something which gives rise to mindfulness, right? If something is a foundation of mindfulness, it is the base for mindfulness. Okay. So it is a basis of mindfulness. That is what this translation is saying. That satipatthana means like a base or a cause of mindfulness. But in fact, that is not very accurate, because you will find that when you read the sutta, you actually have to be mindful already before you can start satipatthana practice. So it's not so much a basis of mindfulness, it is actually a usage of mindfulness. You have to be mindful, and then you use that mindfulness in your practice. And the more recent translation by people like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is one of the most accomplished of translators, he calls it now the establishing of mindfulness. You establish mindfulness on a particular object, and that is what satipatthana really means. Or the one which I think is even better is the focuses of mindfulness. In other words, you take mindfulness and you use that mindfulness to focus on certain object. So I think the focuses of the mindfulness is probably the best translation of satipatthana. And that gives you a very clear idea what this is about. It's about attending on certain objects. If focusing on certain objects, attending on these objects. That's the purpose of this thing here. So now I will just start reading from the sutta itself, and I will comment on some of these things as we go through the sutta. So, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasadamma. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. "Bhikkhus," "Venerable Sir," they replied, And the Blessed One said this: "Bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four focuses of mindfulness." Okay, so this is like the Buddha sets the stage for what he's going to say. He just sort of explaining briefly here what this purpose, the ultimate purpose of this is. One thing I didn't say in the introduction, which I should have said, I should have mentioned about this sutta, I should have said something about the historical development of this sutta. Because one of the things which I often like to talk about regarding the suttas is to remember that it is possible to study the suttas on a comparative basis. You can just study the Chinese version of the suttas. They often have a Sanskrit version. They might have a Tibetan version. And when you compare the different versions, you can sometimes filter down what is like a more original, earlier version of the suttas. Because sometimes they have changed a little bit over time. Almost all the central teachings of the Buddha are exactly the same across all the Buddhist traditions. But sometimes you can find small differences, and they are very useful to actually look at those differences to understand that evolution that has happened over time with the suttas. And it turns out that the Satipatthana Sutta is one of these suttas that seems to have evolved over time. And you can see why, because it is a sutta that has like blocks to it. It's almost like made up of little blocks, and it's very easy to put a new block into this sutta so as to sort of expand it and add another theme of practice, so to speak. And this is very important because it means one of the things that I want to point out as we go through this sutta are the things which are more likely to be earlier aspect of the sutta and which are more likely to have been added after the time of the Buddha himself. And this can be done, as I said, through comparative study. I'm not going to say anything about this introduction, but later on I will talk about this. Okay, so the Buddha says here, "Bhikkhus, this is the direct path." Of course, as always, just because the Buddha says bhikkhus doesn't mean that it doesn't apply to anybody else. It's just that he would normally give and address the monks. That's why it says bhikkhus there. Of course, it's equally applicable to bhikkhunis. In fact, there is an alternative version of the sutta where the Buddha starts by saying bhikkhus and bhikkhunis at the beginning. And of course, it's also equally applicable to lay people when you are involved in meditation practice in this way. Then you have this expression here. This is the direct path. The Pali here is Eka Yana Mago, and Eka Yana Mago quite literally means Eka is one, Yana is like going, one going, and Mago, Magga is path, like in Atangika Mago, the Eightfold Path. So Eka Yana Mago means the one going way. Often this has been translated as the one and only way, for example. But the clear meaning of this word, and it occurs in another place in the sutta as well, is the path that leads in one direction only. It goes in one way. In other words, when you practice the Satipatthana, you go in one direction. You go towards one goal, the one going path. So even direct path is not, I think, quite right. It's more like the, in my opinion anyway, it's more like the path which leads in one direction only. It leads towards Nibbana. It leads towards the overcoming of suffering and the ending of defilements. So this is the path which leads in one direction only, for the purification of beings. Purification of beings, this gives us a clue to the purpose of Satipatthana. There is two types of purification. The first type is the immediate purification of the mind. You try to overcome the hindrances in the mind, because when you overcome the hindrances, it gives you access to samadhi, it gives you access to insight. As long as the hindrances are there, you will not be able to see clearly, and you won't be able to focus the mind in samadhi. So this is the first meaning here. And you can see, this fits very well with what I was saying before, that the purpose of this practice is to lead to samadhi, because you have to purify the mind before you can actually get to samadhi in the first place. So this is the first meaning of purification, to overcome the hindrances or defilements that are in the mind here and now. And the second meaning is the complete uprooting of these defilements, destroying the defilements completely. And this is equivalent to becoming like awakened or enlightened or becoming an arahant, if you like, in the Buddha's teachings. So the teaching here has this twofold meaning here. Purification, first of all, to lead to samadhi, and then after samadhi, the full purification of the mind to lead to awakening. And then it is for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief. And of course this, you can see here, this is all about overcoming dukkha, overcoming suffering in life. All of this is about overcoming suffering. And of course that is the whole purpose of the Buddha's teaching, is to overcome suffering. And to overcome a little bit of suffering, Satipatthana works, and to overcome all suffering, it works. Again, it is a gradual thing here, whereby all types of suffering are included. Then you have for the attainment of the true way. The Pali behind this is nyaya. Nyaya is often translated as method. And the meaning of this is like a general rule or a universal rule which is applicable to the world, how the world works. It's a rule or a way that the world actually functions. And in other words, what the reality as it actually is, behind appearances, so to speak. And one of those ways that reality is often spoken of in the suttas is as dependent origination. Dependent origination is the way the world actually works, according to the Buddha. So nyaya here, this word, the true way, is often defined as dependent origination in the suttas. That is what is meant here by the true way. So if you want to attain the true way, in other words, if you want to understand dependent origination, if you want to understand, basically it's about understanding the Dhamma of the Buddha, that's what dependent origination is, then you practice Satipatthana. So what we are talking about here is the time when you understand the Dhamma, the time when you understand dependent origination, is the time when you become a stream winner, a sotapanna. That is the time when you first see the Dhamma as the Buddha proclaimed it. That's when you attain the true way. So this here is a reference to stream entry, to becoming a sotapanna. And the last one here, for the realization of Nibbana, that happens when you become fully awakened. When you become an arahant, that is called the realization of Nibbana. It basically just means the destruction, the ending of all the defilements permanently and for good. They can never arise again in the future. You can see a kind of gradation here, what's happening here. It is for the purification of beings, which mainly means overcoming the defilements of the mind. And then you have the stream entry, and then you have the full enlightenment here. And all of this is included in Satipatthana practice. All of these wonderful things is an outcome of the practice of Satipatthana, which is the four focuses of mindfulness. So that is the Buddha's introduction to Satipatthana, why we are doing this. And then he gives a description in brief. Now this description in brief, which comes now, is very important because it helps us to understand what Satipatthana is. It describes, gives all these adjectives to describe it. And this description which comes now is the description that you normally find in the suttas. So this is how it is normally defined. The long description which comes afterward is only found in the Satipatthana Sutta, but the short one is found numerous and numerous times everywhere. So this, for that reason, is actually quite important to understand this one. So what are the four, says the Buddha? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So that is the brief formula for Satipatthana. And for those of you who don't know the suttas very well, it's probably a bit cryptic what is meant here. It probably isn't all that clear, so I will go into some detail as to the meaning of this. And please, if you have any questions, you can just raise your hand at any time as we go through, because sometimes questions arise as we do this. So, he says here, first of all, the Buddha starts off, he says that a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. Yeah. The first thing here, which is interesting here, what does it mean by the body as a body? What is the meaning here? Yeah. And this particular translation, the body as a body, is taken from the commentaries. The commentaries have this idea that you define the body, it is narrowed down as just the body, not taking it as a self, not misconstruing it in a certain way. And for that reason, it says the meaning here is a body as a body. But the Pali actually reads, kaya kaya nupassi. Anupassi means to contemplate or to watch, and kaya is the body, and kaya means in the body. So quite literally, if you are going to translate it literally, it means contemplating a body in the body. And I say that that is actually the better and preferable translation. And the reason for that is when I read the suttas, I always try to understand the suttas by referring to other suttas. If the commentary says one thing, but I can actually find an explanation in the suttas themselves, that, in my opinion, is the preferable explanation, because that is then how the Buddha explained these things. Remember, the commentaries are things that were spoken hundreds and hundreds, sometimes 1,000 years after the Buddha. And nobody really knows exactly where those explanations came from, whether the people who taught them really knew what they were talking about, or perhaps they didn't fully know. So if you can find an explanation in the suttas themselves, it is preferable. And you will find that when you read again in the Anapanasati Sutta, which is in the same book here, Majjhima Nikaya 118, you find the Buddha says that the reason why watching the breath is called body contemplation is because the breath is a particular type of body. It is a body among all possible bodies. And you have to remember here that the word body in English, just like the word kaya in Pali, a body means a group. It means a conglomeration of things. It means like a whole body of things. Like in English, talk about a body of evidence. A body of evidence means a whole group of evidence, all this evidence put together. Yeah? And in the same way, in the Pali language, kaya is like a group. It's a grouping. So when you talk about the breath as a body, it means all possible breaths are in this group called the body of breath. And that is the meaning here. So when the sutta talks about, this is how I understand the meaning, I should probably say, when the suttas talk about a body among bodies, it literally means the breath body as opposed to any other type of body. And it is most likely here concerned with physical aspects of the physical body. So the breath is one of those physical aspects. So a body among bodies, or a body in the physical body, is another way of looking at it. So that, to me, makes this expression very clear, what it's about. It's about watching one particular group of things as opposed to other aspects. So that is what we're talking about here. So it doesn't just mean the physical body. It can also mean physical aspects of the body, such as the internal organs, for example. And we'll come to that afterwards. That's another group, is all the internal organs, another group of the body. And that gives a very clear idea of what the meaning here is here. Contemplating here, contemplating, I think, is a good translation of the Pali anupassi. Anupassi literally means to look, to look along with. So you are like looking along with when things are happening here. If you're watching the breath, you are looking along with the breath. So you're following the breath, you're contemplating the breath. You're seeing it as it actually happens. That is the meaning of that word. Then you have, so he abides contemplating a body among bodies, ardent, fully aware and mindful. Ardent, the Pali word is atapi, and it is related quite closely to the Pali word virya. Virya, it means energy, so you have energy. And the purpose here is that at this stage in meditation practice, there is a natural energy in the mind. It says, for example, if you look at the seven factors of enlightenment, they start off with mindfulness. The second one of them is investigation of phenomena, and then you have virya as the third one. So once you have mindfulness there, you are also, usually also, you have virya, you have energy in the mind. It's a natural energy that arises when mindfulness is stronger. So because we already have mindfulness when we do satipatthana, we're here talking about the natural energy that exists in the mind when you have mindfulness. In other words, you are keen, you're interested, you have this energy. This energy is like also similar to an interest in the object. If you're really interested in something, you have energy towards the thing you're interested in. This is a mental energy, right? Not a physical one, but the mind is energetic, keen. One is interested in what you're doing. It's like when you go to a lecture and you're really interested in what's happening. It's like the mind has energy here, and you're alert and you're there. You're with what's happening here. And this is what it seems to mean here with this word energetic. You are interested. You have energy here. Fully aware. This is, here is actually, the word here is sampajano. Sampajano. Is normally translated in this context as clearly comprehending. And the purpose of this word, as explained in the commentaries, is that you know why you are doing this, you know the goal, the purpose of what you're doing. So this is an aspect of wisdom. And the way it is sometimes explained, like Ajahn Brahm likes to explain meditation, is to remember the directions, what you are doing here. In other words, here you are remembering what you're actually doing. You don't forget what you're doing. So you're just sort of veer off course, so to speak. But you have at the back of your mind always the purpose for why you're doing this particular practice. And to give you an example, this, actually the last one here is mindful, satima. So you have to be mindful as well. And to give you an example of the distinction between mindful and fully aware, imagine that you are driving, you're going somewhere here, and the person, maybe you are just sitting in the car and somebody else is doing the driving here. Now, that person who is doing the driving, it's possible to be fully aware, fully mindful of what's happening, to see the traffic lights, see all the cars around you, but completely forget where you're supposed to be going here, that you're going completely the wrong direction here. And end up in the wrong place, and yet be fully aware all the way along what's happening here. And that is mindfulness without clear comprehension, without what is here called fully full awareness. In other words, you're mindful, but you've forgotten the instruction of where you're going. You note everything that's happening, but you go into the wrong place because you've forgotten what you're supposed to be doing. A full awareness and mindfulness is when you're aware that everything is happening and you keep in mind the goal of where you're going. So you end up, when you drive, you also end up in the right place. And obviously, if you're going to drive, you need both. You need both the awareness so that you don't go through a red light, you don't crash into the other cars. And you also need to keep at the back of the mind where you are going. Both are important. And it's exactly the same in meditation. The full awareness, the clear comprehension, is to always have in the back of the mind the purpose of why you're doing this. Because without the purpose, you are kind of veering all over the place without really knowing where you're going. So that is the clear comprehension, the purpose. And then lastly is mindful. And this is what is so interesting here, is that mindfulness is mentioned right here at the beginning. In other words, you have to be mindful to practice satipatthana. And this shows you that the purpose of Satipatthana is not really to become mindful, it is to use mindfulness once it has been established. That is the purpose. Of course, that mindfulness also does increase even further while you practice Satipatthana. That's obviously the case, because all meditation practice and all of these things always improves things even further. But you have to be mindful already. In other words, you have to have that presence of mind to be able to even start out with Satipatthana practice. So all the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path that lead up to this point, they establish you in that mindfulness so that you can do this particular practice. And then the last one here is having put away covetousness, grief, and grief for the world. And this is, to put it mildly, rather hard to penetrate when you just read it like that. It's very difficult to understand what is meant here. So I will again explain to you what this is all about. And the purpose of this phrase is quite obvious when you consider the previous factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. The previous factor is right effort. And in right effort, the purpose there is to overcome, again, it uses exactly the same word, covetousness and grief. Covetousness and grief in Pali is abhijja domanasa. So by right effort, we are trying to overcome abhijja and domanasa. These two things is actually what we're trying to overcome through right effort. And because we are trying to overcome those things through right effort, once we come to Satipatthana, it says we have overcome them because we did that in right effort. That's why here it says having put away these things, because you put those things away in the previous factor called right effort. So what is it that we actually have put away here? It says here, covetousness and grief for the world, abhijja domanasa in Pali. Now the way this is explained in right effort is through sense restraint. In other words, you restrain your senses so you don't get abhijja. Abhijja means like desire or covetousness. In other words, you don't get any desire towards the objects of the senses. And domanasa means like the negative mind state in relation to the things that you get through the senses. So what it really means, and this is how I would like to translate this, is you don't get any attraction or repulsion to the world of the senses. That is how I would translate this. In other words, you have put away attraction and repulsion to the world of the senses. Now that makes it much more clear what the meaning is here. In other words, you have a mind that is balanced. You stand back. You don't have strong desires or strong aversion for the things that is happening through the five senses. Your mind is balanced. Your mind is clear. You don't have this all this stuff going on which attracts you and repels you in the world. And I'm sure you can see that sometimes. Sometimes you feel very content, you feel very at ease, you feel very relaxed about things, and you don't have all these, you feel that even when you see something nice, you don't feel any strong desire for this thing, or you don't get upset if you can't get things, because you feel relaxed and at ease in the world. At other times, you find yourself having very strong reactions to the things that you see or hear or feel through the body. And you may get very averse towards some of the things that happen. Or you may get strong desires to those things that happen through the five senses. You can see it. It's very important here to relate these things to your own experience so you understand what's going on. And it is that mind which stands back, which is contented and doesn't react to the experience of the senses. That is the type of mind we're talking about here for you to be able to do Satipatthana practice. So the meaning of having put away covetousness and grief for the world is that your mind is neutral. It doesn't go out to the objects of the world and gets attached or repelled by them. And the reason it says for the world here is because the world here means the world of the five senses, which means touch, smell, tongue, sight, and hearing. These are the five senses. And also any mental part of that world where you think about these things and you are attracted to that world through the thinking. So all the six senses are really covered by this. And only when you have done that can you have mindfulness. One of the things that you find in the suttas is that sense restraint and mindfulness, they turn around each other. It's very fascinating because in some suttas it will say you have to have sense restraint before you can have mindfulness. In other suttas it says only when you have mindfulness can you have sense restraint. So you wonder, what should I do first? What is actually going on here? How can this be the case? And the answer is that when you really have sense restraint, only then does mindfulness become really stronger. But at the same time, you use whatever mindfulness you already have established, however strong it is, you use that to improve your sense restraint. And when you have really good mindfulness, sense restraint becomes automatic because you're standing back, you can see everything that's happening, and very quick, because you can see everything that's happening in your mind, you can very quickly learn how to react in the right way to sense impressions. So that is the purpose of mindfulness here. You can actually, it's like you're guarding yourself naturally because you have strong mindfulness. So this is the formula in brief for contemplating a body among bodies. You already have to be mindful to be able to do this. Okay, so, and of course, body here can mean many different things. So that's why it's not defined any further. It can mean all kinds of different types of bodies. The next one, now we can, this is becomes easier because now we have done most of the work. So he abides contemplating feelings as feelings. In other words, I would say again, he contemplates a feeling among feelings. Ardent, fully aware, mindful, having put away attraction and repulsion in regard to the five senses. So again, the same principle applies as before. Feelings as feelings really means a certain feeling among all possible feelings. You're contemplating on a certain group of feelings instead of contemplating everything here. And you will see this later on, that when we get to the actual explanation of this, it talks about you contemplate, for example, spiritual feelings versus worldly feelings, or just worldly feelings, not spiritual feelings, or you contemplate painful feelings or happy feelings. In other words, you choose a subgroup of feelings. And again, this is quite clear, particularly in the Chinese version of this sutta. It says this very clearly, again, referring to the Anapanasati Sutta. It says that as you practice this, when you do Anapanasati, you are focusing on a certain feelings among all feelings. So this seems, in my opinion, to be the right way of understanding this particular slightly obscure Pali phrasing, Vedana, Vedanesu, Vedananupassi, contemplating feeling among feelings in the Pali. And again, it's all the same as before. You have to have that energy in the mind. You have to have... we have to be clearly comprehending. In other words, you know what you're doing, you know the direction, you know the purpose of this. You have to be mindful already, and you have to put away attraction and repulsion for the world of the five senses. He abides contemplating mind as mind. Again, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away attraction and repulsion for the world of the five senses. Mind as mind, the Pali here is Chitta. Chitta literally means mind, but chitta also means mind state. In other words, it's not necessarily the whole mind that you're contemplating here, but it's a certain state of the mind among all possible mental phenomena. So for example, if your mind is in a certain state, for example, your mind is like tired or whatever, that's a certain state of mind, and you can contemplate that tiredness, or your mind is very peaceful and very concentrated, unified in samadhi, that's another state of mind you can contemplate. So all of these different mental states that occur from time and again are here the subject of contemplation here. That is when meant by contemplating mind as mind. In other words, he contemplates a particular state of mind among all possible mental states. And again, we'll see later on what that actually means. The last one here is he contemplates mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away attraction and repulsion for the world of the five senses. Mind objects, the word here is Dhamma. So what Again, it is certain dhammas among dhammas that he's contemplating. So I would prefer to read this, that he abides contemplating some dhammas among all possible dhammas or among other dhammas. But this is what is translated here as mind objects. And dhamma, this word dhamma in Pali, can mean, is very wide in its meaning. And it can mean like phenomena, it can mean almost anything. So one way of translating this is he contemplates some phenomena among all phenomena. Phenomena is anything in the world, basically. Anything that can be contemplated is a phenomena. And that is how widely dhamma is used sometimes. But one of the things that seems to be paramount in this dhamma contemplation is the understanding of causality. Dhamma can have this meaning of causality in Buddhism, because dhamma is like the teaching of the Buddha, and the teaching of the Buddha is a teaching on causality very much. It's understanding how things arise dependent on other things. It's understanding causality. This is a very important aspect of the Buddha's teachings. And that's why I said before, when you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, it is not just eight factors that are put together randomly. There are eight factors that have a particular causal sequence. They follow one after the other. One causes the next one. One is the condition for the next one. And in the Dhammanupassana, it is the same thing. When we get to that chapter, you will see that one of the main things here is thinking about the five hindrances and also the seven factors of awakening in terms of how they are conditioned, how they are caused, how they come about. If you really want to overcome the five hindrances, first of all, you have to understand what they are. So you have to look inside of yourself and actually know what these things are in your own mind. And the second thing you have to do is to understand how they arise in the mind in the first place. By understanding how the hindrances arise in the mind, that makes it possible to overcome those hindrances. And this contemplation of the Dhammas, one of the main aspects here, is to understand this causality. How do these things arise in our minds? Once we understand their scope, what they are, how they arise, then we can start to do something about it. Then it becomes possible to actually develop the mind. So this is very, very important part of the Buddha's teachings, this understanding of causality, how things arise. So I think one of the main, I must admit this is a slightly difficult one, this last one here, but one of the main aspects here is understanding causality, the Dhamma Nupassana, causality of certain phenomena in the mind. So that is Satipatthana in brief. I'm not going to do the whole sutta today. I'm just going to tell you straight away. I'm going to do this over at least two parts. So I'm going to do the next part in a fortnight's time. I'm going to come back again in a fortnight and finish it off. But because it's just too much material to go through in one go. So I'm not going to be here all afternoon, just to, in case you'll be getting concerned about that. That is the brief one. And it's important to understand this particular brief one. This is maybe the most important aspect here. Because this is the thing that you see in the suttas again and again and again. So now you know when you come across it, you have a certain reference to understanding what is being talked about when the Buddha talks about these things. Now, having gone through the thing in brief, after this, now come all the different exercises, all the different ways of doing these contemplations. This is what happens after this. And you will see here there's a large number of contemplations here. Now, for the body contemplation, first of all, it starts off with mindfulness of breathing. Then you have the four postures, the full awareness. Then it's called one thing called foulness of the body here. And then elements. And then the charnel ground contemplations towards the end. Now the interesting thing here, and this is where the comparative study becomes interesting, is which one are all of these exercises equally original? Do all of these exercises actually go back to the time of the Buddha? And to find that out, when you do a comparative study of the different sources of the Satipatthana, you find that the only exercise that they all have in common is the one which here is called foulness, the bodily parts. So it seems very likely that the foulness, the bodily parts at least, is very original and most likely goes back to the Buddha himself, because it exists in all the different versions of the sutta.
Excuse me.
So that is very likely to be the most original of all of these. The second most original is probably the four elements, because the four elements exist in almost all the versions. There's about seven different versions of the sutta, and the elements is only missing from one of those. So that is also quite likely to go back a long way here. So if you want to know what the really original part of mindfulness of the body is, it's bodily parts and possibly also elements, which is the most original. And then you have the charnel ground contemplations come after that. And then the first three here are not as likely to be part of it. That is mindfulness of breathing, the four postures, and full awareness. These are less likely to be original aspects of Satipatthana. So because of that, I will do the one which I feel is the most likely to be what the Buddha meant when he said body contemplation, first of all, and that is the bodily parts. So that is the fourth aspect here on page 147, paragraph 10. So it is called foulness here, and the reason it is called foulness here is because the Pali word is asubha. Subha in Pali means like beautiful, and asubha is therefore here taken to mean non-beautiful. In other words, foulness is how they translated it. I don't think that that's necessarily a required translation. Asubha, when they have the A in front, it just means that you are not subha, you're not beautiful. In other words, non-beauty is literally what it means. And I think that is probably a better translation than foul, because foul, there's nothing really in here which is necessarily foul. It's just that you are seeing the body for what it actually is, rather than having some kind of romantic fantasy about it. That is what this is all about. And the point is not to become disgusted with the body. The point is simply to take away some of the infatuation and attachment to the body, whereby you have a neutral regard for the body, neither disgusting nor beautiful, but like the middle way of equanimity. That is the purpose of this kind of practice. Take away the lust and desire. That's why we do this. That is important. So I feel foulness is too strong, and I will just call it non-beautiful. The contemplation of the non-beautiful, asubha. And it concerns the bodily parts. So this is how it goes. Again, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin, as full of many kind of impurity thus. In this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends, full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus. This is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, these are peas, this is millet, this is white rice. So too, a bhikkhu reviews this same body in the way above, as full of many kind of impurity thus. In this body there are all of these things. These are the 31 parts of the body, they are called elsewhere. So, what you can see here is that it's just like reviewing a bag with many types of contents. It has beans, it has peas, it has this kind of thing. So it is like a dispassionate viewing of the body. It's not something repulsive. There's nothing repulsive with the red rice and beans and peas. It's just something. It's not actually neither repulsive nor beautiful, except maybe if you're very hungry, it might be beautiful. But it's just neutral, really. And in exactly the same way, You are watching the body, just looking at it for what it actually is. Okay, there are these things in the body here. And the point here is you don't really necessarily have to see all of these things that are in this list, because these days it's quite easy. You know, we have medical, we know the autonomy of the body. You know what's inside. We know what's there. It's quite easy to think about what's in the body. The lungs over here, the heart is here, the liver is down here. And it's quite easy to remember the contents of what's inside of you. And you can almost visualize that. And if you have a difficult time visualizing what's inside of you, there's plenty of material available, like medical books, all these kind of things, which takes the body apart and you can see all the contents inside. It's quite easy. And the purpose, of course, here is that when you look at the body devoid of skin, when you take the skin off, the body isn't all that beautiful anymore. What is inside? It's just there. Some people might find it repulsive, but really it's just what the body is. It's a neutral kind of thing. But it's not something that you are normally attracted to. It's not something that you feel desire to. It is only the body, when it is complete, that seems desirable. So by doing this, you are helping to overcome the desire for the body. And so what you can see here is that this is an exercise for overcoming desire. And this is what I was talking about before, that Satipatthana, the purpose here, is to help us overcoming the refined defilements. By doing this, we are overcoming the desire for the body. When you overcome the desire for the body, you can let the body go. Because you don't have any attachment anymore, you can let it go. Attachment is what stops you from letting go of the body. It's what stops you from going into deep meditation, because you're holding on. So this exercise helps you with that letting go, so that you can go into deeper states of samadhi and of meditation. So that is what this is all about. And you can also see here what I was mentioning before, that Satipatthana is both about vipassana and samatha. Vipassana is about clear seeing of the body. So what we're doing here is we're looking at the body for what it actually is. Well, this is actually what it is. It has these 31 parts or whatever. You can probably multiply that a lot if you want to, or reduce it down. But it has all these things. We are seeing the body for what it is. We're not looking at it just superficially, what it is on the surface, but we're actually seeing it for what it is. So in that sense, it is vipassana, because it is a clarity of seeing. It is not being deluded by the superficial appearance of things, but looking below the surface, quite literally in this case, to see what is actually there. And what we're seeing is not as beautiful as we would otherwise see. That's why it leads to vipassana. It is a clarity of sight. It is clear seeing. You can call it insight if you like, but I think insight is too strong a word, because insight to me is like wisdom. It's like a radical new way, but it's like a gradual clear seeing here. And it's also samatha, because as with everything else in Buddhism, when you see things clearly, you become peaceful. Why? Because you're letting go of desire and attachment. When you see that the body is not as attractive as you thought it is, you let it go, you become peaceful. Desire is always about holding on to something, grasping onto something. It is the mind is agitated to some extent. When you let go of that, you become peaceful. So this exercise is both samatha and vipassana, and it leads towards samadhi. So that is what this is all about, this particular exercise. Again, it is not about seeing the body as repulsive, but just seeing it for what it actually is. Everybody happy with that one? Contemplation of the 31 parts of the body. By the way, it's not, sometimes people say the 32 parts of the body, but the 32 parts of the body is actually a thing found in the commentaries, and they add the brain as the 32nd part. But the suttas, for those who are really interested, only have 31 parts of the body, and the brain is not mentioned as a separate part here. I'll go a little bit more. I'll do the refrain here as well, because the refrain is quite an important one. So once we have seen here the the exercise itself then comes like a refrain. This refrain is the same for each exercise, and it explains how we are supposed to do this particular exercise. Now we have to go back to paragraph 5 on the previous page, because there it is in full. And this is how you actually relate to the exercise. And it says, in this way he abides contemplating a body in the body internally, and he abides contemplating a body among bodies externally, or he abides contemplating a body among bodies both internally and externally. Or else he abides contemplating a body among bodies, the nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating a body among bodies. So here we have, basically, this is how you're supposed to do the contemplation of the 31 parts here. And you can see, first of all, it says that you do this contemplation internally. Internally here means in relation to yourself. It means regarding your own body. That's what it means by it internally. Then you do this contemplation externally. In other words, you think that other people too have bodies which consist of 31 parts or whatever. Then you do it both internally and externally. And the point here is that the most important thing is to do it towards your own body. Because when you do it towards your own body, that is really how you overcome desire for the body. And it's your own body which is the most important one, because that is the one you want to let go of in your practice of meditation. And there's an interesting sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya which says that the reason why you are attracted, for example, to a person of the opposite gender is because you identify to some extent with your own gender. If you didn't identify with your own gender, you wouldn't have an attraction to the other gender. So if you're able to overcome attachment to your own body and to your own gender in that sense, it means that you're also overcoming attraction to the other gender at the same time. So you are actually, just by contemplating your own body, you're already going in the right direction there. But of course, it is not just your own body, it's also the body of others. And the last one here, both your own and others. What is happening here, I think, the best way to understand this is that this is like a universalization. Now suddenly you realize all bodies are of the same nature, whether it's yours or the body of others. It's a universal truth that applies to all body. So both internally and externally is that universalization of understanding of how bodies actually work. And that's why I think it says both internally and externally there. It doesn't mean you contemplate lots of people at the same time and yourself makes it very complicated. It's just a universal understanding of what the body is like. Whereas the two previous ones, internal, externally, are directed to specific bodies, the last one is a universal understanding here. Then you abide contemplating the nature of arising in the body. And this basically means that you understand how the body comes about, and you also understand the nature of vanishing. You understand how these things disappear. In the terms of the body, it basically means death. When you die, the body disappears. When you're born or when you're conceived, that's when the body arises. And you understand both at the same time. You understand that the body both has this vanishing and arising and vanishing capability here. Now, the interesting thing here is that you will notice, and this is an important part of the Dhamma, that the Dhamma is always structured according to particular sequence. Nothing is really random in these kind of sequences. They always have a particular structure. And there is a reason why the contemplating eternally, externally comes before the contemplation of arising and vanishing. And the reason is the first one, contemplating internally and externally, is about overcoming the desire for the body. It's to take you towards samadhi. And you will see this in a sutta, particularly in the Digha Nikaya, called the Janavasabha Sutta, I think it's called. I think it's Digha Nikaya 18 or something. In that sutta, it is specifically explained that this is a samadhi practice, this first one here. Now, the second one here is obviously a vipassana practice. You are contemplating the arising and passing away of things. So you can see here that first of all, you attain the samadhi through contemplating the body just in an ordinary sense. And then, secondly, you have the vipassana, or the deep, in this case, it actually means the deep insight experience of the body, how it arises and how it vanishes. In other words, you understand the body in a much deeper sense. So samadhi comes first, then comes the understanding of what the body is actually like. So there's like two aspects here of vipassana. The first is the initial aspect where you understand the body and you overcome the attachment to the body by seeing it as it actually is in terms of its internal organs. And the second that aspect of vipassana leads to samadhi. And then the second aspect is understanding the arising and vanishing of the body. And this is a much more profound aspect of vipassana. This is the kind of insight that leads to much deeper wisdom, in a sense. So there's a layered approach here to the practice. First you get to samadhi, then you get to a deep understanding of things. And then the last part here is even more profound. Because then it says, or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary. It says here, for bare knowledge and mindfulness. I think it's better to translate this as for limited knowledge and mindfulness. The Pali word is matta. It means a measure. It means a certain amount. And it is the opposite of complete knowledge and complete understanding. So it's like a limited amount of knowledge and understanding here. And this limited knowledge and understanding is opposed to the last one here, where he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. To abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world, basically means full awakening. This is arahantship. So this is the full knowledge, the full understanding here. The previous one is the limited knowledge. And I think that might mean, like, it's not clear exactly what it means, but I suspect it might refer to stream entry here. So you have the first part, where you practice to get samadhi. Then you have the insight aspect, where you understand the body as it actually is. As a result of that, you get to stream entry, the limited knowledge and mindfulness. And lastly, you get arahantship, not clinging to anything in the world. You can see the structure here. It's a very clear structure how this works. And that is how the suttas are always described, always very, very structured. And lastly, it says, that is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body, or a body among bodies. So the interesting thing here, of course, is this particular paragraph. And again, using comparative study, how much of this paragraph is actually goes back to the word of the Buddha himself. And again, if you do the comparative study, you find that the first part here, the contemplating internally, externally, and both internally and externally, that is the one that is found in almost all versions of this sutta. And that is particularly the aspect which leads you to samadhi. And of course, that fits with what I was saying before, that the purpose of Satipatthana is to take you to samadhi. So it makes sense that that should be the most important aspect here of this particular practice. And then the rest of the of this paragraph is a little bit more uncertain exactly how original it is. I don't think that it is any of this is necessarily wrong or bad, but it might not be as original as the internal, external, and both internal, external contemplation. So this just goes to show again that the main purpose here, why we're practicing this, is to overcome defilements of the mind. That is what this practice of Satipatthana is all about. So I'm going to stop there because I've already gone on for quite a long time, and I'm going to, in a fortnight's time, I will come to part B. So if you aren't bored out of your mind, you can come again next time and get more of the same. Are there any questions before we stop? Yes.
It's about the body, our attachment to it.
Yeah. Essentially, but it's not so much that it isn't your body. It's just that you don't have any strong kind of strong kind of desire for the body. You know, you don't have any kind of big. In particular, this is about it's about basically sensual desire. What it comes down to here, the more you see the body as something which is not beautiful, the less sensual desire you have for the body. It's the first hindrance, basically. That's what it comes down to most of all. Sensual desire arises because you see the beauty in the body. Sensual desire is always comes from, and this is comes back to what I said to before about causality in Buddhism. Everything has to do with causality. Why does sensuality arise? Because you see it as beautiful. Don't see it as beautiful, it doesn't arise anymore. So the first hindrance is weakened very, very strongly. Yeah.
You're
right. It's just it's conditioning from the past, right? It's just how you've been conditioned from the past. There's all the influences throughout your life, through past lives, through whatever, sort of add up to make you. You know, this is what Hugh is all these conditionings, and this is just your personal way of looking at things. You know, another person might disagree completely. Say, what you can't possibly like. Like her, I like her, but I don't like her, or whatever it is, or I like him, or whatever. You know, this is just personal conditioning. This is one of the things. The Buddha doesn't often talk so much about where things come from. He is not so interested in that. He's very pragmatic. He's just saying, well, there is a problem. Let's solve it. Let's not find out where it comes from. It's like the universe. You know, most religions talk about, well, the universe was created by a god, or it came into being through this kind of mythology or whatever. The Buddha said, well, actually, you can't know how the universe came into being. You look back in time, and there's always another cause before another cause, going back infinitely. There is no... You can never find a first beginning. But it's not really the point anyway. We have a problem right now. That problem is suffering. Let's do something about it. Very pragmatic, very to the point. Yeah. Any other questions before we call it a day? Yes, Peng.
The external body, is it always just somebody else and not your own external?
I think in this case, it probably refers to somebody else. Yeah. Go through your own body. Your own body is most important, yeah.
And then the external body, when you do it, you go through somebody else's body.
Yeah, yeah.
Same as you do your own.
Yeah, yeah, same thing, yeah. And then in the end, you universalize and you say, oh, all bodies are like this, and you sort of throw them all out the window. Yeah. So. Okay, everybody happy? Yeah. Let's pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.